This is Dan Ray, the host of Nightside. I hope you enjoy listening to the Nightside podcasts here at the Nightside website, and I invite you to join us every Monday through Friday night from 8 to midnight for Nightside on WBZ News Radio 1030. I am delighted to welcome back to the program, I believe for the third time, a gentleman who I consider to be really the preeminent expert on gun ownership rights in America, Dr. John Lott. He is a columnist at FoxNews.com. He's an economist, formerly chief economist at the U.S. Sentencing Commission. Dr. Lott, welcome back to Nightside. How are you?
Well, it's great to talk to you again.
You really have spent your life looking at the numbers, looking at the statistics. And for those who are listening, you are an advocate of Second Amendment rights. There's no doubt in my mind of your position over the years. And you also have felt, I believe, or have actually concluded that stricter gun control laws do not make safer communities. As a matter of fact, I think your studies have suggested just the opposite of that.
Right. Well, I mean, I don't approach it from a Second Amendment issue. I really don't think about it in terms of that at all. To me, what got me interested in looking at this issue was basically what impact it had on crime and safety for people, whether gun ownership increases, saves lives, or whether it costs lives. And my views have changed a lot over the years since I started working on this problem. But, but you're right. What you find often is that gun control laws may be passed with the best of intentions. We see something bad that happens, and the natural reaction is, well, if we just get rid of the guns, bad things won't happen. But unfortunately, what you find is that when you pass these laws, many times you end up having it so that the law-abiding good people are the ones most likely to obey the law and be affected, not the bad person. And so, you know, look around the world. Every single time that guns have been banned, either all guns or all handguns, murder rates and violent crime rates have gone up. You know, we've seen it in the United States with places like Washington, D.C. and Chicago. Huge increases in murder rates in both of those places after bans went into effect. But it's not just been true there. It's around the world, whether, you know, even island nations, places that you think would be the ideal experiment, because often when you're talking about places like Chicago and Washington, D.C., people will say, well, you know, criminals can get guns from Maryland or Virginia or from the rest of Illinois or Indiana. And so they say it's not a fair test unless you are able to ban guns entirely in a country. But we've seen that. We've seen it even, as I say, in island nations. And you still see the large increases in murder rates that occur after the bans have gone in place.
Well, a lot of the – and I have, you know, gun control advocates on the program a lot, and they will pull up statistics, and they'll say that the murder rate in America compared to some of the Scandinavian countries, or for that matter to England, which I believe does have strict gun control laws. Is it possible that people can look at the same numbers and come to genuinely different conclusions? I mean, how do you square the numbers that people have thrown to me about Britain, that they're, you know, a similar population, English-speaking nation, a country that is based on, you know, on the Magna Carta and us on the U.S. Constitution, respect for law and all of that. How do the numbers seem to be interpreted differently, I guess would be my question.
Right. Well, I mean, you're right. A lot of people say, look, the U.K. has strict gun control laws, has very low gun ownership rate, relatively low homicide rate, and therefore it must be the strict gun control laws. The way I would normally respond is to say, look, before they had the strict gun control laws, they had even lower murder rates and even lower violent crime rates. You know, you look after the 1997 ban on handguns in the country there. In the next 8 years, the homicide rate increased by 50%. It only started to fall after that and then go back down near to where it had been previously, because they had about an 18% increase in the number of police officers right at that time, because people were so upset about the high violent crime rate. They have a lot of other violent crimes are quite common in England compared to the United States, even if the murder rate's relatively low. But, I mean, the big difference that you have generally is just we have a much worse drug dealing problem. You know, people don't appreciate how 2% of the counties in the United States, about 60 of the 3,140 counties in the United States, account for over half the murders. And if you look at any of those cities, a murder map for those areas, what you find is that even within those areas, murders are very heavily concentrated in usually two or three hot spots. And that's basically because you have, you know, gangs and drug gangs. I mean, even the Obama administration, I mean, I may not agree completely with their report, but they claim that up to about 80% of crime generally in the United States was gang-related, and the vast majority of that was drug gang-related. So we have a worse drug gang problem than a lot of countries have, and it's you have drug gangs fighting against each other in Chicago and other places to try to go and control drug turf.
My guest is Dr. John Lott. He taught at the University of Chicago, although he's not in Chicago tonight. And he is an expert on statistics as it relates to crime and gun control laws. There's also a trend that he has commented upon recently, and that is an upsurge in the number of concealed handgun permits that are being sought by women and by minorities, and probably for good reason. We're going to get into that and get into some of the reasons for it. And if you'd like to join the conversation either, and if you want to ask a tough question, that's fine. He can handle tough questions. If you are someone who disagrees with him, feel free. If you're someone who agrees with him, you're more than welcome as well. 617-254-1030, 888-929-1030. I inaccurately characterized him as a Second Amendment advocate. I will step back from that characterization. He very politely corrected me and indicated that he basically is looking at numbers. He's an economist, and that the numbers drive his conclusions. So with that characterization clarified, we will continue our conversation. Feel free to join the conversation. 617-254-1030, 888-929-1030. Coming right back on Nightside.
Danny?
That's my name. Don't wear it out.
Are you listening to me?
We're doing the Nightside Shuffle.
Nightside with Dan Ray.
We're doing the Nightside Shuffle.
On the radio.
WBZ. News Radio 1030.
My guest, Dr. John Lott, he's an economist, and his area of specialty, one of his areas of specialty, is basically dealing with crime. He has done a lot of work in conjunction with the Crime Prevention Research Center, the author of 9 books, including More Guns, Less Crime. His latest book is The War on Guns, Arming Yourself Against Gun Control Lies. That book is just out about a year or so. How's that been received, Dr. Lott?
Well, I think it's gone well. I mean, it's sold well, and I think I hope it provides people a lot of useful information about issues that are in the current debate over guns.
Okay. There is apparently a pretty substantial uptick about people who have sought permits over the last 10 years or so, actually. And even a big jump last year, minorities and women lead the growth. Why is that?
Right. Well, just so people know how big of a change it's been, you go back 10 years ago, as you mentioned, there were about 4.6 million concealed handgun permit holders in the United States. Earlier this year, it was up to about 16.4 million. So from 4.6 to 16.4 million in 10 years. But it's even bigger change.
Well, that's a 400% increase. I'm not a statistician, but correct me if I'm wrong. That's a 400% increase.
Yeah, no, almost. And the rate that people are legally carrying guns has actually increased even more than that, because 10 years ago you literally only had a few states that you didn't have to have a permit in order to carry. And now there are 14 states where you don't need a permit in all or virtually all of those states in order to be able to carry. So there's been the number of people who are legally carrying now has actually increased much more than that fourfold increase.
Okay, what's the cause of that?
Well, I think there are a lot of things that are going on. I think there's been a sea change in people's attitudes towards whether guns make them safer. You look at surveys from Gallup or what have you, you see a large majority of Americans think that owning a gun in their home makes them safer. You go back to 2000, for example. Gallup's had a survey that they've been doing over the last 20 years. In 2000, only 35% of Americans thought that owning a gun in their home made them safer. By the end of 2014, that was up to 63%. You see similar changes in polls for asking, do you feel safer living in neighborhoods where other people are owning guns? So it's not just even you own yourself owning a gun, but you feel safer knowing that your neighbors are owning guns. You see about 60% of Americans in different polls think that they feel safer knowing that their neighbors own guns.
I assume that poll would talk about neighbors legally owning guns.
Yeah, sure, right.
Okay, no, I'm assuming that's a distinction that's important.
No, I agree, and I think it is an important distinction. And also, you see similar changes in asking people whether they feel safer knowing that others are carrying concealed. What's been interesting, though, is not only have you been seeing this general change in survey results, but you've seen particular changes in how women and blacks have been answering those polls. Now you have clear majorities of both women and blacks feel that owning a gun in the home makes them safer. And you've seen corresponding changes in women's ownership of guns. So if you look at concealed handgun permits, see, a lot of the surveys that you have, though, you're always worried, will people honestly answer the questions whether they own a gun or not? And there's real reasons to believe that over time, as people, let's say, get more skeptical of government and other things, they become less inclined to say whether they own a gun, even if they do.
Yeah, I would also think that people would perceive that as a pretty personal question. And putting aside even the concern about whether or not government at some point might want to know who owns and who does not own a gun, you might want – that's the sort of question that I think would be similar to questions about activity in the bedroom.
Right. No, I agree. So I guess to give you a simple example, Illinois has what's called a FOID card. You have to have a FOID card issued by the state government before you can own a gun legally in the state. Well, the number of FOID cards have almost doubled in the last 15 years in Illinois. And yet, if you look at these surveys that ask people whether they own a gun, these surveys claim over the same period of time, the percentage of people that own guns has supposedly fallen by 40% in Illinois. I would put more faith in kind of the hard numbers, and things like concealed carry permits are a good example of that. So if you look over the last 4 years where we have good gender data across the country, over the last 4 years, the percentage of men with permits has increased by 22%, but the percentage of women with permits over the last 4 years has gone up by 93%. And you see a similar type of thing for blacks. The percentage of blacks who have concealed handgun permits has increased about 30 percentage points faster than it has for whites.
Well, I would think that if I was living in an area like, for example, on the south side of Chicago, the vast majority of people on the south side of Chicago, black or white or whatever their background is, I'm sure are not there intending to injure their neighbors or fellow residents. But with the infusion of drug activity and gangs that do exist, Chicago on any given weekend is a shooting gallery. As I understand, there are more murders in the city of Chicago than there are in the cities of Los Angeles and New York combined.
Right.
Which
one of the big problems with Chicago and a few other places is you can get a concealed carry permit, but it's very costly. To go and get a concealed carry permit, when you add up the fees for the permit and the training costs, can be around $500. And the problem that you face then is, who are you stopping from being able to go and get a permit? You know, wealthy white people in the suburbs probably don't have a problem, but the people that my research finds who benefit the most from owning guns are the ones who are most likely to be victims of violent crime. And that overwhelmingly tends to be poor blacks who live in high crime urban areas. And so I think, you know, it's a great change that we see that blacks and women who also benefit disproportionately because they're relatively weaker physically, and a gun represents a much bigger change in their ability to go and protect themselves than it does for a man. You know, we see, I think, the result of research and other things has been changing people's perceptions about who benefits the most from having guns. You know, the big problem is, you know, we look across the nation, you have about 36% of all permit holders now are women. But you have certain places like New York City or Los Angeles or D.C. where you have to go and demonstrate need to some local public official. So you have two types of concealed carry laws. You have those where once you're a certain age, you pass a criminal background check, you pay your fees, and you apply for a permit. It's up to you whether you apply for a permit, but once you do, it will automatically be granted. But then you have eight states where you have to demonstrate need to some local public official.
Like and one of them is Massachusetts, John.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And in those places, what you find is very different group of people who get permits. I was able to go and get a list of all the permit holders in Los Angeles County and go through it. And what you find is that in those heavily Democratic areas where it's public officials decide whether or not you have a good reason to have a permit, the people who get permits are overwhelmingly white males, wealthy, politically powerful, politically connected white males. You know, it's just ironic. You know, Democrats claim that they care about helping poor people, and yet the only people that they let pretty much go and have permits to have guns to carry them are wealthy whites. So,
well, it sounds like to me that oftentimes, you know, Democrats and others will argue that we need sort of a progressive tax rate. It seems to me that these gun control laws, if you put it sort of in an economic context, these gun control laws are very regressive because the
right.
people who are most harmed are the people on the lower end of the economic ladder and also
right.
who happen to be, in most situations, most vulnerable. If you live outside of Boston in some of what I like to call our Tony suburbs, the chances of you hearing gunfire in Wellesley or Weston or Wayland on any given night is de minimis. But if you live
right.
in some of the urban areas where there is gun activity and drug activity and crime, it's almost a nightly occurrence. So there's a lot of irony here. We're going to get some phone calls, if it's okay with you. Dr. John Lott is
sure.
my guest. He is an economist, okay, and he specializes dealing with issues dealing with gun ownership and how gun ownership impacts either helpfully or not helpfully crime rates. That has really been his life's work. He's an economist, a formerly chief economist at the United States Sentencing Commission. He's a leading expert on guns and has talked about that issue and done literally hundreds upon hundreds of op-ed articles as well as radio interviews and in conjunction with the Crime Prevention Research Center, author of 9 books, More Guns, Less Crime. That is his analysis, his latest book, The War on Guns, Arming Yourself Against Gun Control Laws. You can reach him at you can get him on Twitter at John R. Lott Jr., JohnRLottJr, at John Lott, John R. Lott Jr. We'll get back to phone calls right after this break. If you'd like to chime in with a question or a comment, and if you're a gun owner and you would like to stand up and be counted, you're more than welcome. And if you're someone who's skeptical and you'd like to ask Dr. Lott a question or challenge what he's saying, the number remains the same, 617-254-1030, 888-929-1030 from anywhere within, really anywhere east of the Mississippi River.
I want you to speak freely.
If you only knew the power of Nightside.
I want to listen to Nightside.
And the only way to convey it is by your talk.
Till the night closes in.
Nightside with Dan Ray.
Till the night closes in.
WBZ News Radio 1030.
My guest on the line, Dr. John Lott. He is an economist and an expert on the relationship, the interrelationship between gun control laws and gun control communities that have strong gun control laws and crime. And he concludes that there is no relationship whatsoever. As a matter of fact, he believes that, and if I'm misstating this, please correct me, Dr. Lott, that tougher gun control laws do not reduce crime, and that crime actually goes up in communities that have tougher gun control laws as a rule. Fair statement?
Yeah, no, I think that's right. Look, we all want to try to keep criminals from getting guns. The problem is you have to be careful that you're not going to primarily disarm law-abiding good citizens and not criminals. So, for example, when you have a ban on guns, you know, just as a simple example, you know, basically it's the most law-abiding good citizens who turn in their guns, not the criminals. And to the extent you disarm relatively more of the good law-abiding citizens relative to criminals, you actually make it easier for criminals to go and commit crimes. Look, higher arrest rates, higher conviction rates, longer prison sentences, the death penalty, they all deter criminals from going and committing crimes. But so does the fact that a potential victim might be able to go and defend themselves. When I was with the Sentencing Commission, I must have read well over 1,000 transcripts of criminal cases. And, you know, they have a certain pattern to them. So you may have two robbers that the police have caught, and one of them turns evidence against the other, and the prosecutor will be there and say, okay, well, how did you decide to go after the particular victim that you did? And the person will say, well, you know, we knew the drug dealer down the street had a lot of money, but it would be suicide to go after the guy. And we thought about maybe going after a cab driver, but a lot of cab drivers have guns. And so, you know, they would see a relatively small-looking person or a woman who looked like a really easy target. And they said, well, you know, it looked like an easy target, so we decided to go after them. Yeah, criminals are no different than other people. If they can do a job in an easier way, they'd rather do that than do it in a hard way and having victims who can't defend themselves serve as easy targets. Yeah. And we see this in many different ways. You look at the issue of gun-free zones, these areas where we try to make safe places by banning guns. Well, the question is, who obeys those laws? It's basically the law-abiding good permit holders who obey that, not the criminals. And in fact, these serve as magnets. There's time after time where we have statements from these mass public killers who will explain that they took, you know, either telling others before the attack or leaving diaries or other things that will indicate that they picked the target that they did because they knew it was easier for them to kill people. So you have, you know, last year you had a case in Detroit where a father was concerned about his son's involvement with ISIS. Fortunately, he told the FBI. The FBI put a tap on his phone. And they recorded an amazingly chilling conversation where this 20-year-old man was explaining to a compatriot of his that he had decided to attack one of the largest churches in the Detroit area. And the reason why he had picked it is that church had banned people from having permanent concealed handguns on church property. And he explained to his compatriot that that would make it easier for him to go and kill lots of people before anybody could arrive on the scene to stop him. Just to give you an idea of the mentality.
Sure. Here. Well, look, the criminals, they're not going to Mensa meetings necessarily, but they're not stupid, and they're not going to put themselves in positions of great danger. I got a whole bunch of calls for you, Dr. Lott, so I want to get to them if you don't mind. Let me go to Mark in Lowell, Massachusetts. Mark, you are on Nightside with Dr. John Lott talking about gun control laws and their impact. Go right ahead, Mark.
Good evening, Dan and Dr. Lott. First off, I'd like to say Dr. Lott is 100% on his theory on, you know, gun violence and stuff. It's not people that have a license that cause these problems. You know, and in states, different municipalities where gun laws are stricter, there is a higher crime rate because the average citizen cannot defend themselves. You know, I live here in Lowell. Lowell has turned around and totally rewritten their own law on allowing you to carry a handgun. I've had a license for 42 years, 43 years plus. And when I just went down to renew, I was told, Well, if you want to be able to carry for protection of life and property, which the state says that's the license that gets issued, you have to go to special training in order to get it. They want me to spend more money besides the $100. Now, I applied on June 5th for my license, and I am still waiting to get it in.
Let me ask you this, Mark. Have you ever been involved in any criminal activity in your life?
No. I've had a permit for 43 years.
Sure. And how old are you, sir?
I'll be 62 Thursday.
Okay.
When my permit expires.
Did you ever serve any military time?
Yes, I did. I served in the United States Marine Corps.
So you're in the United States Marine Corps, 65-year-old, former United States Marine, without a criminal record, and they're giving you a hassle and throwing obstacles in your way. Welcome to Massachusetts.
Yeah, I guess so. You know, we just can't seem to get an answer from the city council or anyone why we have to go.
Because there is no answer. Dr. Lott, comment on Mark's situation. Lowell, Massachusetts is a lovely city, wonderful people. But, again, the path to hell is paved with good intentions.
Right. Well, I mean, he was mentioning the cost of the additional training and what have you. Now, these are just ways that effectively change the type of people who can go and get permits. He can afford to pay the extra hundreds of dollars to go through the additional training. But, you know, it's one way of making sure that relatively poor people, the people who are most likely to be victims of violent crime, aren't able to go and protect themselves. So in California, you have some counties where they make you have to spend more than $1,000 to be able to go and get the training. Permit fees can be as high as $385 to go and get a two-year permit. In New York City, it's about $450 to go and get a three-year permit just to pay for the permit, and then you may have to spend, you know, half $1,000 or more to go and get the training that would be required to go and qualify. That's even if they let you have it.
Well, Mark, small consolation, but you're not alone.
No. One other question, Dr. Lott. Who could possibly give me better training in the proper handling and care of a firearm than the United States Marine Corps?
No, I mean, I agree. Look, there's been opposition for many years for even police carrying concealed handguns around the country. You have, your late Senator Ted Kennedy, for a decade, he filibustered a bill that would allow police who have at least 10 years of experience to be able to go and carry with them when they travel around the country. He argued that would be a public safety risk to have these, you know, off-duty police officers who, again, had at least 10 years of experience as a police officer, be able to go and carry with them. But, you know, these were people who wanted to be able to carry. They, in some sense, were providing a public servant for free. I mean, we trust these guys with a gun when they're on duty. But, you know, permit holders are incredibly law-abiding, as your caller was just saying. Police officers are rarely convicted of any type of firearms-related violation. They're convicted of firearms-related violations at about 1/31st the rate of the general population. But permit holders are even law-abiding compared to police officers. Permit holders are convicted of firearms-related violations at about 1/10 the rate that police officers are.
Wow.
And so, you know, it's the type of person who goes through the process to be able to get a permit knows that they have a lot to lose if they go and do something wrong. These are law-abiding citizens. So if you become a felon, your life is going to be unalterably changed.
Well, one of the lead Supreme Court cases, the Otis McDonald case, older gentleman on the south side of Chicago, just wanted to protect himself. He won the right, and then the city of Chicago turned around and said, okay, you got a right to have a gun, but you can't walk out on the street with it. You can only carry it at home. So they will come up with all sorts of reasons to limit law-abiding citizens. Mark, I got to run. I'm up my break. Great questions.
All right, thank you very much. I'm going to continue to listen to the rest of your show.
Semper Fi, Mark.
Semper Fi.
All right, have a great night.
Why don't you talk? Do it.
Nightside. With Dan Ray.
Well, what's it to talk about?
Call 617-254-1030 or 888-929-1030. WBZ News Radio 1030.
Back to the phones, John in Marblehead. John in Marblehead, you're on with Dr. John Lott. Go right ahead.
Yes, I would like just to comment that there's an 80-year-old man who served in the military and had a license to have my .22, my rifle. It was canceled, I guess, 6 years or seven. Anyway, a number of years ago, and I welcome the opportunity to say that since I am a law-abiding citizen and have served in the military, demonstrated the use of the weapon, that I know how to fire it, and then to have my license canceled, I really do object to this, particularly as I live alone, and particularly in this day and age, have the option, if it became necessary, to use my gun to protect myself.
All right, well, we agree totally with you, John, and that's wrong, and I don't know what you can do up there. One of the things you might think about is hiring an attorney and going and try to assert your rights. You fought for those rights. Those rights should be yours.
I mean, it's pretty sad. One thing I will say is we kind of missed a bullet with regard to the Obama administration. One of the last rules that they had put forward was, before they went out the door, was a Social Security rule that said that if somebody got help with their finances, so in my family's case, my mom had given my sister power of attorney to go and pay her bill because my mom was in her late 80s, didn't want to have to deal with computers, hated using computers. But according to the Obama administration rules, she would be banned from being able to own a gun as a result. There have been about 4.2 million elderly Americans that would have been prevented from owning guns. Fortunately, one of the first things that President Trump did when he got into office was to overturn that. But, you know, hiring lawyers, you're right, you can go and do that. But now you're making somebody have to spend thousands of dollars in order to have the option to be able to go and defend themselves.
No, I understand. I'm just trying to, knowing Massachusetts, the only thing they will respond to is having an attorney and threatening court action. John, I got a whole bunch of calls I want to get to. You keep listening to Nightside, okay, my friend?
Well, just as a question, please, why do I need an attorney to, in effect, renew or get my license back?
Well, John, I can just explain to you that in Massachusetts, essentially the local authorities have carte blanche. They do not have to even give you a reason, as I understand the law. And so in order for you to assert your rights legally, if you're dealing with a police chief who's not prepared to give you an honest explanation, the only way you can secure that explanation is through going into court. I hate to tell you that, but that's the status of the law in Massachusetts. There were some police chiefs in Massachusetts who had a blanket policy. They would not have given anyone a gun permit if they lived in their community, and they wouldn't care if it was a Green Beret, Navy SEAL, 34-year-old veteran in perfect condition. So that's the answer. It's not the answer you want, but that's the answer, okay?
I wish to thank you very much for taking my call.
You're welcome.
It's been something that's been bothering me for about 3 years.
Well, I'm glad you made that call, and I want to get to a couple of other callers. Thanks, John. Have a great night. Let me go to Lee in Illinois. Lee, you're next on Nightside with Dr. John Lott. Go right ahead.
Thank you, Dan, and WBZ for your service to the community. I'm going to date myself here. I live in southern Illinois on the border of Missouri and Kentucky, mm-hmm. and we have to have a FOID card in Illinois. Right. When I grew up, we had a one-room schoolhouse, 8 grades. There was about a dozen of us. We'd bring our rifles and shotgun to school, lean it up against the side of the school, so when we got home, on the way home, we could hunt for our rabbits and squirrels for supper. How times have changed. But in Illinois, you got to have a FOID card so you can get ammo, but you could just go across the border in Kentucky. You could buy milk, beer, and ammo with just an ID card. So it really doesn't work in Illinois. I know about 10 years ago they outlawed guns in, I believe it was Australia, and the crime rate went up about 400%.
Let me see if Dr. Lott is probably familiar with that statistic. Are you aware of that statistic, Dr. Lott?
Yeah, it's kind of an internet type thing. First of all, Australia didn't ban guns. What it did was it had a buyback, which reduced the number of legally held guns by about a third. But then people were able to go out and buy guns again. It just, you had to have licensing and what have you, and it was more costly. But the gun ownership rate now is actually back to about what it was prior to the buyback.
Well, that's good to hear, at least in Australia, Lee.
Well, my point is that when I grew up, a gun was just a tool, and now it's not.
Yeah.
It's not just rural Illinois. If you ever go and read the autobiographies for Colin Powell, for example, who grew up in New York City, or former Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, they grew up in the 60s. They were on riflery teams. They describe carrying guns with them down the streets of New York City, to take their guns to school, leave them in the back, unlocked in the back of classrooms in the 60s, and take them home with them.
Well, gun control advocates have demonized the inert object. They've been able to demonize the gun. Lee, I want to get one more in, David from New Jersey.
It's ammo. Okay? It's ammo that kills people, not the gun.
I hear you.
Just a stick.
Thank you so much, Lee. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.
Thanks. Call anytime. Love to hear you. Hear from your voice. David in New Jersey. David, next on Nightside.
Thank you for taking my call, Dan. Dr. Lott, gentlemen, I wanted to ask statistically, in light of as to how Illinois dragged their feet kicking and screaming into issuing concealed carry permits in court a few years back.
Well, that was the Otis McDonald case.
No. This was post-McDonald. They dragged their feet for several years, if memory serves, going as late as 2013. But what I wanted to ask, Dr. Lott, is for the gun control capitals of California, Massachusetts, and especially the People's Republic of New Jersey, what statistically do you recommend as a course of action for people to take so as to remedy this? Because people like Chris Christie, is pathetic as he is on the Second Amendment, his replacement is going to be far worse. And I was just wondering statistically what you see as the best course of action for people to take. Thank you.
Right. I think, the big thing that's going to be started to talk about in September is national reciprocity.
Hurrah,
if you have a driver's license in Florida, you can drive to Massachusetts or California or wherever. You have to obey the local traffic rules, but you're able to go and drive across the whole country. If you
have
a concealed carry permit, though, most states have some reciprocity agreement with other states. But, I get calls from cab drivers all the time, or truck drivers, where they may be having to go through New York or New Jersey or Illinois or California, and they find that they're not able to carry there, and they're essentially banned from having guns with them on their entire trip because of the regulations in those places.
Let's do this, gentlemen. David, I'm flat out of time in this 9 o'clock hour, so I got to let you go. But I think the issue you just raised, Dr. Lott, maybe we can have you back sometime in the next month or 6 weeks and talk about that effort for national reciprocity, if that's okay with you.
Thank you,
David.
People can find more on our website at crimeresearch.org, crimeresearch.org.
I'm going to give that website, crimeresearch.org, on the other side of the 10 o'clock news. Dr. Lott, I'd like to thank you personally if you'd stay on the line just for 15 seconds or so.